Hi, I'm Doug Keck, and welcome to The Catholic Sphere. Each week, we tackle topics important to Catholics around the globe with a different host and a different focus. This week, our subject is theology. Our topic is Condition Critical, Why Catholics Need to Be Concerned About Critical Theory. And this week, we are joined again by philosopher mother and author of End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us, by Carrie Gress. And she joins us today from Virginia. We also have a pastor from the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., known from our radio audience, and he's the author of the latest book, The Hell There Is, An Exploration of an Often Rejected Doctrine of the Church, Monsignor Charles Pope. And as always, we have EWTN's Vice President of Theology, Colin Donovan. He joins us from our theology studio. Thank you so much for joining me again. Great panel, and talking about something interesting, critical theory. Well, let me ask you, Monsignor, to talk about critical theory. We hear a lot more about critical race theory, but there's something broader than that, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, critical race theory was coined very popularly back around 2020 and following, but it's part of just critical theory, which it kind of, just, I would say, simplistically divides up the world, but there between the oppressor and the oppressed, you know. There's the rich and the poor, the haves, the have-nots, the bourgeois, the proletariat, you know, the first world versus the third world, and yes, also black versus white, mm-hmm. you know, and so on. And so the problem is that the whole goal really seems to be to divide, to get us attacking each other. There's so many other issues with it, but I'll just say that at the heart of it, it explains a lot of why we're at each other's throats so much today, and things like identity politics and just the savageness of some of the discussion out there, mm-hmm. Because people have been told you are being oppressed, even if you're not aware of it, you are. And, you know, there's seldom any talk about self-inflicted wounds like overspending or addiction or having children outside of marriage. And it's still the fault of the oppressor that you made those right. bad choices. So it leads kind of down a dead end. And the goal seems to be just to have us at each other's throats. Mm-hmm.
So let me, Carrie, you're the philosopher on the panel here officially, so let me ask you about this philosophy and maybe a little bit where it came from and the idea that it does seem to be we kind of live in this world where, hey, it's not my fault, man.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this goes back to Marx, certainly. Marx set up the system where it was the classes that were against one another, that the upper classes were oppressing the lower classes. And the problem was is that it only went so far. There were only so many upper classes that could be killed by the Soviets. And so the idea needed to be broadened out. And this is really where the Frankfurt School, people like Herbert von Kuse and Wilhelm Reich came from. And they thought, what if we change this dynamic? And it's no longer just a class warfare. What if we change this to male, female. That's certainly what we see in the feminist version of it. And then, of course, we can add on to race. We can add on whatever we want. And so it's this Marxist theory that then reverberates through the culture and keeps, as Monsignor Pope said, just keeps dividing further and further and further. And the remarkable thing is that this was sold. You know, the Soviets were able to come in and sort of take over Russia through military force. But I think the Frankfurt School recognized like they didn't have that capacity, and they knew it would go better if it was something that they could infiltrate through the actual culture. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. It was peddled to us in very soft terms through things like magazines, but also certainly through feminism and through all these different ways in which the culture, you know, the academia, colleges are a prime example of the way in which it was passed on through the academics and then down to the students that then became you know, incredible activists and very politically involved and social justice and, you know, all of the kind of protesting that we see, too, it really originates from this place.
Right. Well, let me ask you, Colin, and Carrie talked about the Marxist character, as did Monsignor Pope, mm-hmm. and the Frankfurt School. What was the Frankfurt School? We hear it mentioned a lot, but what was it?
Well, it was a school which basically in the West took Marxism, applied it in the various academic fields. Critical theory tries to do that. Whereas the church had a particular approach, an approach where theology derived from the data of revelation, the faith, as it were, and philosophy studying the causes of being, and then rational theory, induction and experimentation, fleshing out the natural sciences. This sort of suggests that, well, instead of that theory of everything which Christianity has, or at least the Catholic Church has, we will make this viewpoint, this division, a theory of everything. We will apply it in economics, in politics, in all other disciplines, in psychology, and the humanities in general. And that's exactly we've seen what happened. In essence, what Our Lady predicted at Fatima, that if Russia was not converted, it would spread its errors. It has done that. And it did it through schools such as the Frankfurt School, through processes and you might say infiltration into academic life in the West, and to the point where, as we described in the previous show, the smoke of woke, and are seeing here, it's pretty much infiltrated all of the areas of politics, economics, and culture, as was the design. And I think that's what makes it sort of an end stage of this process, that an idea meant to displace the influence of culture coming from, on culture, coming from the church, coming from the gospel.
Well, let me ask you, Monsignor, playing off of that, the idea of the lack of social mobility, obviously a lot of what happened, as Carrie was saying as well, in the class warfare, that kind of fell away because there was that kind of social mobility. But now they've come up with this idea that basically says you're going to be an oppressor at one moment and then not be an oppressor depending on which group or which intersectionality you're dealing with. So you might have, as we've seen recently, Jewish people, usually considered a minority, usually considered an oppressed group, is no longer oppressed. It's the oppressor because of the situation having to do with Gaza.
Yeah, and so as I say, this... In some ways, it affects, you know, in our country, white men most of all, but it does shift around, and it's an equal opportunity batterer. And I would say that, there's also sort of I can't even improve. So if I'm a white male, therefore I'm an oppressor. But there's nothing I can do to improve my condition. I'm just going to be that. Even when I think I'm being less racist or less misogynist or whatever, no, that you're still showing yourself as an oppressor because you're setting the terms. And no matter what I say or do, I can't even get out of it. It interrupts any real discussion of the complexity of issues. That there's usually a lot of blame and a lot of reward to go around on all sides of living in this world. And I would also say it undermines fundamentally our gospel, which talks about love for one's enemy. Not, you know, I want to hate them as the oppressor. And likewise, you know, that we are different, especially like men and women or black and white, but we all have equal dignity before God. So there are differences, but there's equal in dignity. This is all part of the gospel. Jesus talked about servant leadership. If you're going to be a leader, you're going to be a servant. Nope, you're just an oppressor. And we hate you because you're an oppressor. Well, you see, this is where, again, there's no room for anyone to improve. It could be that someone is an oppressor, but how could they ever change? No, not until we say so.
Right. Well, Joseph of Arimathea and the other Pharisees who were in the oppressor class would not have done very well, apparently, and certainly Gaius or any of the other Romans who became faithful followers of Christ, likewise, could never get out from being an oppressor.
Right. Yeah, and that's it. And as I say, it's funny how, take a woman CEO. In some ways, you think, well, now she's moved into the role of oppressor because she's got all the power. But no, she's still a woman, and therefore she gets to qualify. You see what I'm saying? There's a lot of strange labeling that goes on that doesn't realize that there are complexities. There's a lot of very good women in very powerful positions, a lot of African-Americans, a lot of, you know, as they like to say, black and brown people in very, very good positions. But that still doesn't cancel these categories. And it's a very strange phenomenon hard to cancel and hard to get out of or in, just because someone has a preconceived notion that if you're this, you're oppressed or you're right. oppressor.
Well, let me ask you, Carrie, you, in academics and things like that, they talk about microaggressions again, as the mm-hmm. Monsignor was yeah. talking about it, the idea that you don't even, I'm not cognizant of all these things that I'm doing. I'm just doing it because of my background, and you don't understand mm-hmm. how that impacts someone else who has a different background, mm-hmm. who's just determined or decided to see themselves as a victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a fascinating thing to look at, because in one way you can see that woke has moved in as a way in which we determine how we ought to behave, who the good people are, who the nice people are. And it's all about power, too. I think that's another fundamental piece, that how it varies so dramatically from Christianity, is the idea that it's about power. And of course, Christianity is about humility and love and charity. So it's come up with its own structure in which people can engage, and they need to, we're sort of always constantly grasping at, like, who's the victim that has the highest status, and then the rest of us, are sort of balancing out where we are in the totem pole, if I can even use that example, without appropriating someone else's culture. But in any event, yeah, I think this is the amazing piece, is the fact that we can literally be told that we're harming somebody by not even engaging with them at all. There's nothing physical happening. It's really just the words that we say have become right. combative. And I think and that's where the power comes from, is that we're all sort of left unsteady and unclear about how it is that we ought to behave.
You know, connecting this with the last show we did as well, you made a comment in the notes about in the kind of the mystical idea of DEI. Explain that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's this idea of victimhood. It's, mm-hmm. That if you are a victim, you have this kind of magical status. And it's not something, the status of victimhood is a Christian idea. It wasn't actually until Christianity came along that said, we're going to, if you're suffering, we're going to help you, whether it was in hospital or orphanages. Those things just didn't happen previously in other cultures. But that's been usurped and really turned on its head. And so mm-hmm. instead of bringing you healing or helping you, we're going to entitle you and lavish on you all of this praise. And governmentally, we're going to give you all this entitlement and opportunity. And so, of course, people are grasping onto that. So, again, you can see this power structure going on, mm-hmm. but it's completely opposed to a Catholic point of view.
Right. Let me ask you, Colin, in that area, talking about even with the critical theory and the idea of personal responsibility, that, again, the carry forward with that situation, that because of my status as oppressed, you really can't judge me on any of the things that I do or I fail at, because it's really your fault.
Well, one of the biggest difficulties is the one that both Carrie and Monsignor have noted. There's a kind of irrationality to all of this, by which you really don't know where the borders are, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. You look historically, for instance, civil rights movement. The church was in the forefront of that, because it saw to discriminate was to judge people by the category in which you put them. You were black, therefore this. And so laws in the South discriminated, individuals discriminated, and the church stood for fighting against that. But you can't do that today, because the next group of the discriminated or the oppressed, somebody hasn't defined that yet. They've got to get around to defining it. Then we know who the good guys are or the bad guys. And that kind of moral irrationality is certainly mm-hmm. something that has no history in the church. In the Old Testament, there was a certain element of it. If your father committed a great crime, the scripture said that the guilt of that passed down to the fourth generation. This was, as St. Paul described it, the law being a tutor, trying to teach the evil of certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of sin that were occurring in Israel. But the prophets also predicted that when the Messiah came, this would not be the case. Each man would be responsible for his own sins, or to turn the aphorism which was used by the prophets before regarding Israel, if the father ate sour grapes, the children's teeth would not be set on edge. Well, the trouble today is you don't know what the sinful thing is until the groupthink tells you what it is. So there is no getting ahead of it. There is no moral rationality to it. And there is certainly no, moral stand which you can take with something you don't know where it's going to pop up next.
Right, exactly. So, Monsignor, when you're talking about that, we talked about the idea of all of these things being dividing, creating conflict. What's the benefit to anybody on this? Is it totally a preternatural, supernatural kind of thing going on, or is there just, in many cases, organizations and groups that can do quite well manufacturing these distinctions?
Well, I think what drives it is that a lot of people realize that they can get a lot out of being a victim, whether in certain entitlements or just excuses. Mm-hmm. So again, the idea of a human moral agency kind of goes away. I'm not responsible. My mother dropped me on my head when I was two, and my father was whatever. And I don't have to really answer for any of those, like I said earlier, those self-inflicted wounds, mm-hmm. things like substance abuse or teenage pregnancy or promiscuity in general or truancy, just skipping out of school. None of these things I will be held accountable for because I'm a victim. And other people are responsible for what I've done. I just never, what is the old saying from West Side Story? I'm not depraved, I'm deprived.
Ah, Officer Krupke, the famous Officer Krupke song, right.
There you go.
Right.
And I think a lot of people get something out of that. They can either evade responsibility or they can get some stuff heaped on them. And those, and as I say, so it's mislabeled. The oppressor really, the oppressed one becomes the oppressor. You owe me now, and I demand reparations. And by God, if you don't do it, you're evil, bad, and moral. And then the rest of us are like quaking because we're so afraid of rejection. And the fear really drives this. If there's something, deeper under the surface, I'm sure it's fear. People, you can get someone afraid of, or the fear of rejection or being labeled. People will do almost anything to avoid that.
Well, what about Monsignor, even inside the church? Somebody say, well, I thought you were a Christian. I mean, you're a Christian. You're supposed to be all loving. You're supposed to be so understanding. You're supposed to be so merciful. If anybody should understand my situation, it should be you.
Well, you see, that's the interesting thing, isn't it, Doug? Because we have reduced in our culture love to mere kindness. Of course, kindness is an aspect of love, but so is rebuke, so is teaching, so is saying no. Mm-hmm. Hopefully any good parent knows that, and all of us have been kids, that if you only just say nice things and are kind all the time, your kid's going to be spoiled. So true love has to insist on the truth, has to point the way, and at times punish mistaken notions. And so love is a many splendored thing. It's not just kindness. And that's where I think those criticisms come from. Oh, you're not being nice. And, but nice has its place, but so does this will end.
Right. Well, they used to say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We don't really hear that too much anymore. Because so many times people excuse things because someone's intentions were good. So, Carrie, in looking at that from a philosophical, academic, and also as being a mother in a parish, how do you see this impacting the way the church deals with certain issues in society and teaching in the church?
Sure. I think the church feels like it's reacting when it actually has an opportunity to really do what it does best, which is teach and guide and lead. One of the things that the sexual revolution has done is what every revolution does, which is tries to isolate people. And that it's in that isolation that people are at their weakest. And this is why the family is always gone after, is because when you have people alone, they don't have the support system around them to really flourish in a culture. And I think this is what the church has the capacity to do, is really help people understand that. One of the reasons why we got into this mess is because we have the belief that each of us can sort of create our own world and our own future and reality, instead of really understanding that roles are important. And part of it is because none of us has the capacity intellectually to be able to sort of dictate how our life is going to look. There's so many different aspects to life, all colliding with one another. And so I think that's one of the things that the church has the capacity to do, is really start emphasizing why roles are important, why mm-hmm. vocations are important, why it is that when we bring this order to culture, when mm-hmm. we bring family to culture, people then have the capacity to really flourish.
Right.
And of course, you know, that's to say nothing of the spiritual gifts that are coming from it. You know, certainly we know how important confession and all of the sacramentals are and the sacraments are in terms of really reconnecting us with God. I mean, that's the right. ultimate isolation is to be disconnected with God. So I think there's an opportunity for us in the midst of all of this ugliness that we've been living with.
Right, absolutely. As the 60s would say, love is never having to say you're sorry. Quite wrong. And as any parent knows, right, Colin? The idea that, you know, sometimes the right answer, as Monsignor alluded to, is no. And it's a lot harder to tell somebody, listen, I know you want to touch the flame on the stove because it looks very interesting, but I can't let you do that because you're going to burn your hand. Yeah. And yes, you're going to cry about that situation. Do you think sometimes we're unwilling to take on that negativity in honor of trying to stand up for the truth and just kind of figure, well, you know, I don't want to get anybody too upset. We're being pastoral. You know, the world has changed. We have a different approach. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's certainly something Mother Angelica always said, you know, that the mm-hmm. easy path is simply to let people do what they want to do and not rebuke them, not correct them, not teach them. And unfortunately, anyone who is holding this ideology very close to the vest, so to speak, or deep within the heart, there's no possibility of teaching because it's so centered on themselves, what they want and what others are keeping them from getting. You see that in all of the applications of it. You know, if you want a PhD, you should be entitled to it. Don't talk to me about the work required to do that. If you want this, that, or the other thing, the same rubric applies to those situations. And it reminds me of something that that Fulton Sheen always said about communism, which I think applies at the heart of Marxism as well. Mm-hmm. And that is that the capital sin is not pride, but avarice. This desire for something I'm not entitled to, I've not worked for, but others have worked for and have, and I want it, even if it means taking it away from them. And I think that's really the mentality of revolution that is at the heart of DEI, at the heart of critical theory, and any of these Marx-inspired ideas of, you know, setting one group against another.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Monsignor, so you brought that up. Would that be another version of liberation theology? I mean, where there's where you end up with this kind of political dynamic where at the end of the day, it's really that you're being oppressed and being kept down. And the way you fix society is not to become a saint, but to become in charge.
Yeah, you know, and of course, Christ did come to liberate us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the angel didn't say to Joseph and Mary, name him Jesus because he will save his people from political oppressors mm-hmm. or from the Romans. He said he'll save them from their sins. And we have misconstrued, you know, as I say, one of the emphases of modernism that's crept into the church, some of that smoke of Satan, is that it's a very this worldly context. It's a social gospel. Uber alles, you know, it completely crowds out the, you know, we always hear about the corporal works of mercy, which are very important and we should mm-hmm. do, but also what about the spiritual works of mercy? What about people's right. souls? You know, you can right. maybe have them get a nicer cassock to lie in one day if you can get them a little more money, but at the end of the day, right. where's their soul going to spend
well,
eternity?
Do you think
this is lost
right. Well, do you think there was an overreaction to the sing for your supper kind of thing where people would say, well, you know, you have to help these people. You can't do it conditionally on the fact that you're going to be barraging them with your religious teachings in order for them to eat.
Yeah. There's a very interesting book written years ago about that by a guy named Marvin Olasky. Mm-hmm. It was on the tragedy of American compassion. And the ministers and priests and, you know, of the churches around the year 1900 were very concerned that the government not get involved in charity because bad charity would drive out good charity. And good charity says, no, you need to do something in return for this, maybe not on all occasions, there's going to be some people who are just very sick. But at the end of the day, generally, they were trying to get people out of self-destructive behaviors. Or, I want you, you're here at the gospel mission, and by gosh, you're going to hear the gospel for your soul before you eat for your body. And that's a respect to the full person. They have souls too, and they need to hear. They need to hear from the Lord. So I think somewhere we have, bad charity drives out good charity is the thing. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until the 1960s, even through the Depression, there were many ministers and priests and bishops who were saying, get the government out of this stuff.
Right.
They don't do good work. We can do it. We're on the ground. We can help people and say, we want you to come to the help set up tables today. And yes, we'll certainly have a meal for you. But you see the vision. I've gone on long enough, but the point is that we have diminished the human person. It's another form of reductionism, another huge issue.
Right, in modern world. In a sense, almost saying, well, we don't think enough of you to expect you to be able to do anything in exchange for this. It's a dumbing down of that. St. Paul would have had a concern about that. So, Carrie, let me ask you your final thoughts on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's incredible because what we really have robbed people of is a sense of purpose. And I have a good friend who's working with people who are homeless. And he said, when you give people who are homeless some kind of sense of purpose, then everything changes. And I think this is one of the problems that has happened also within our marriages and families, mm-hmm. is feminism has taken away the purpose of men. And if we start giving men back their purpose, they can rise to the occasion and look very different than the culture in which we see men today. But absolutely, all of these things are being driven, as Colin said, by avarice, but also by envy and resentment. Mm. And you can just see these emotional things stirring and, creating more and more of this kind of angst towards other people, which, again, is another aspect, another way in which we're isolated. And it's severing this sense of purpose and what it is that God meant for us to do in our vocations. And sometimes that requires suffering and the gift of self. But what fundamentally everyone is missing who engages in these ideologies is joy and hope and charity. And I think this is where the church can come in to start telling us, these are the things you're looking for, and we can fill that hunger.
And as you indicated, that feeling of somebody accomplishing something, something I work for, something I did, which is why, I remember a story just as we go out, somebody was, their daughter was going to college and throwing away a bunch of trophies, and the father said, why are you doing that? Well, these are the ones I got for just being on the team. I'm keeping the ones that I earned. So, I mean, we all need that in our lives. So that's going to wrap it up for this edition of The Catholic Sphere. And I'd like to thank our panel, of course, Carrie, Monsignor Pope, and Colin Donovan for being with us once again. And we thank you, as always, for joining us as well. And don't forget to join us next week when the host will be Ryan Penny. He'll be discussing Catholics on social media. That's right here on EWTN's The Catholic Sphere. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.